This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And you know, as we walk on our main streets, we see lots and lots of people. Some of them, you know, might need a little help. And that's what we're going to talk about today with two representatives of the North Dakota Protection and Advocacy Project. David Boyk and Judy DeWitts join us from our studio in Bismarck. David is Director of Legal Services. Judy is a disabilities advocate for, again, the North Dakota Protection and Advocacy Project. David and Judy, thanks for joining us today.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you.
David, give our listeners a brief elevator speech description of what the North Dakota Protection and Advocacy Project is.
The Protection and Advocacy Project is an independent state agency that has authority under both state and federal law to provide advocacy services to people with disabilities for their disability-related rights and provide protection for people with disabilities from abuse, neglect, and exploitation.
Who do we serve with this organization?
We serve people with disabilities from any age, from birth to death, actually. So we serve anyone that needs that type of assistance.
Well, define the types of assistance that would be covered.
Medical. Health care, there's a lot of issues related to health care. Community inclusion, which includes people with disabilities into the mainstream of community life.
We also include one of the programs we have is Help America Vote Act, where we help educate people on what their rights are as far as the voting system and how that might work for them. So if they have – we work with people where they have guardianship issues, some education issues, whether they have accessibility issues. So anything that really that affects their lives, we encourage them to give us our call. We have a centralized intake. So when people call in, they can visit with the folks that are online, and then they can help them discern what their issues are. Sometimes we find out people are suffering with an issue, but it's hard for them to explain, and sometimes they don't even know what the question is that they might need assistance with. And so we have an intake staff that can help them do that, and so then we can discern from that what we might possibly be able to work with them. Or where we might – we always try to give them an answer. We may know – it may not be something that we can provide assistance for, but we can refer them to somebody that can provide them assistance.
So the issues are many and varied, and your clients many and varied as well.
Very true.
The Protection and Advocacy Project has a website. You can find it easily, ndpanda.org. That's ndpanda.org. A lot of information up there. David, you're the Director of Legal Services. What does that mean to you? What do you do for the organization?
It's a small legal staff we have, so being a director doesn't involve a lot of personnel management. It involves helping to set policy and to determine which cases we will be able to participate in directly or by finding a private attorney who will take the case either without charge or on a fee that we're able to pay.
And do you find that there are sufficient number of attorneys out there that can do that?
No.
And why not?
There aren't very many lawyers who specialize in disability law. And I'm not sure why. For example, in employment discrimination, there are lawyers who take those cases on in the state, but mostly they're representing workers with disabilities who are not wealthy people. And so they basically have to win their case to have money to pay the lawyer. Mm. On the other hand, employers, particularly well-to-do employers, have lots of lawyers ready to serve them.
And Judy, you are a disabilities advocate. Describe for our listeners what kind of job that is.
We work with individuals and help them. Sometimes we have different levels. We may just provide them advocacy and information. We may just refer them to somebody, or we may help. We can step it up. We can step it up to maybe we go with them. For instance, in education, we might help, might attend with a family going to an IEP meeting because they need someone to help them interpret what they need to do and what their options are. We can go all the way up to, like David said, to the legal place where if we do need to go to court, we could do that. But that's the last step. We always try to provide information and assistance at the lowest level possible, because we found that you're not developing enemies with people that you're trying to work with the people that our clients are trying to work with. We're providing them support and helping them solve their problems. So after we help them, hopefully they'll learn how to do that. It's a kind of a way to teach them some tools to make their own decisions and how they might work with the group that's giving them some difficulties, and that would change in the future. So long term, that's a better resolution.
There's also another person in between you and the client, and that is somebody we need to talk about now, the guardian, correct?
The guardians are involved in some cases, yes.
And do you have enough guardians?
Well, the number of guardianships has been growing, and in this state and across the country. Judy has some numbers on that just in the past 13 months.
In February of 2016, there were 2,800 adult guardianships in place in North Dakota. And 13 months later, in March of 2018, there were 3,170. So it increased 13% in 13 months. And from the information that we've checked on across the country, that's very typical across the country. Actually, in many states, it's rising much faster than that. And there is a waiting list on some of the corporate guardians for people that have need a guardian, and one there is no guardians to be had at that point. So it is a rising problem in the state.
And who can be a guardian?
Well, virtually anybody can be a guardian who is an adult and who is not impaired in terms of decision making.
Are these guardians supervised or regulated in any way?
Well, that's just newly developed. Right now, guardians, any new guardian has to take an online course that's available through the North Dakota Supreme Court website on their self-help page. And they have to take and successfully complete this course in order to be a guardian. And current guardians have 2 years, I think, from last March to successfully complete the course, and then new guardians will be taking the course as they are appointed. There also are corporate guardians in the state who have a slightly higher standard, and the corporate guardians basically means that there is an entity of some sort, either a nonprofit or a for-profit, that provides guardianship workers to a specific area that they decide upon themselves. There are a couple of corporate guardians who serve across the state.
And are guardians compensated?
Generally, they are. But, for example, there is someone who doesn't have any financial resources but needs a guardian. There is a public administrator program that each county theoretically has a public administrator, and when cases arise, a court would appoint a public administrator to handle a case, and there would be payment based on a legislative appropriation that is administered by the Association of Counties.
Do these guardians just demonstrate a willingness and take that online course, or do they? Is this somebody you talk to, or somebody like you talks to and says, determines whether they're appropriate to be a guardian under those circumstances?
The court standard really that applies now is completing that guardianship course. And the guardianship course does take an individual through potential conflicts of interest that would make them a poor choice to be a guardian or might disqualify them from being a guardian. The person shouldn't have an offense record, particularly that involve financial trusts.
I assume there's a distinction to be made here between who a guardian and some sort of home health provider.
Oh, yes. The guardian really makes decisions for the individual, and a home health provider doesn't make decisions but provides services in an individual's home.
How is the North Dakota Protection and Advocacy Project funded?
For the most part, we get funds from both the federal and state government. We do have a couple of grants in addition. Judy is spending part of her time working under a grant from the Council on Developmental Disabilities to work on supported decision-making. If supported decision-making is put in place and works, it could take the place of taking the step of going for a guardian, because the individual with supported decision-making would be able to make decisions himself or herself.
Judy, could you get to develop that a bit more? What is supported decision-making?
When the courts are looking for a guardianship, when they're working with a guardianship, one of the things they do is they try to look at the least restrictive requirement for that individual, how they want to live. Supported decision-making would fill that bill in that it empowers individuals with disabilities to make choices about their own lives. You know, we all make choices from the time – we all make choices. Did we buy the right car? Did we do the right thing with our houses? Have we decided where we're going to go to dinner? They're all choices being made. But some people grow up and they're not taught or they're not provided the opportunity to learn to make decisions. And so supported decision-making is one way that individuals can get support to make their own decisions. It's a program where there's an individual, there's a supporter, and then there's agreement drawn up that states what the parameters are on that agreement. The person that makes their own decisions is the individual, but they can have a supporter, which often is a family member or a friend, somebody that they trust that will give them the right information. And that supporter cannot make the decision, but what they do is help gather information. They consider the pros and cons, share that with the individual, say, here are your options, and if you choose this option, this is what may happen, or this may be something you don't want. So they try to give the pros and cons of everything, and then the individual in the end makes their own decision for them. Sometimes people... there are some cases where we've seen the courts will have a limited guardianship where they may have a guardianship for a year or a shorter length of time, and the individual have someone help them in the process of learning how to make decisions, and then that's all the longer the guardianship goes. But it's been shown that the more times people can make their own decisions, they're going to have a much happier life. They feel good about themselves or feel good about the decisions. Doesn't mean they won't make a mistake. We've all make mistakes in our lives, whether we have a guardian or not. We've all done that. But it's a process where we can help people. And it's a possible alternative to the high number of guardianships. People, just because they can't make a decision on one thing, doesn't mean they can't make a decision, all the other decisions in their lives. So that's basically what the supported decision-making program is about. We currently have, like David said, we currently have a grant, and we're trying to involve as many stakeholders as we can across North Dakota to take a look at this program and how it should be developed, what should go into it, what's the positives to do it, what we don't, what the concerns are, and how it could be developed to meet the needs of the citizens of North Dakota. So we're just in that process. We started in February. We have a steering committee of 10 different individuals representing people from young people through the elderly, all the different disability issues, and trying to get a lot of input from a lot of people. And with the steering committee meets, and we're working with people from across the country trying to gather as much information as possible, share that. And then we've been having a couple polycoms, and we'll have more across the state, open to anybody and everybody, so that we can have a conversation with them. What do they think? What do they think is right? What do they think is wrong? What are their concerns? So it's a process that's being started.
Judy DeWitz is a disabilities advocate. David Boyk is Director of Legal Services for the North Dakota Protection and Advocacy Project. Thank you both for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Main Street, a Think Global, Act Local essay from Alexander Cusa.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of 750 Touchstone Cooperative consumer-owned utilities dedicated to innovation, integrity, and commitment to community.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, President Jefferson joins us and answers many questions.
On the eve of my annual trip to the Lewis Clark Trail in Montana and Idaho, we had a visitor who said, "More listener questions, please," and we have done exactly that.
We've got a couple of questions about Jefferson and the ocean, one about his ocean voyages.
Comparing John Adams' heroism on the high seas with Jefferson's timidity, Jefferson only was in a ship twice, once going and once coming from France.
We also got some questions about how President Jefferson managed his time so successfully.
Answer: discipline, organization. Never waste a single moment. He who never wastes a single moment will never complain of a want of time, said Jefferson.
And we got a number of corrections, including my error. John Hancock was born in Massachusetts.
Not New York, as we erroneously said.
Sorry about that. Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. When we communicate, more is being shared than the words we use. From a change in tone to nonverbal communication, there's what we say and how we say it. Essayist Alexander Cusa calls himself a third culture kid. He grew up moving around a lot. His mother spent 25 years working with refugees for the United Nations. He's lived in many countries, including Rwanda, Switzerland, Ethiopia, and the United States. Today, Alexander shares tips about how to use words to build connection.
How many languages do you speak? Is it hard to learn a new language? These are the type of questions I hear from people intrigued by my exotic accent. Today, I want to talk about universal language. I don't mean universal languages like those spoken everywhere, like English, French, Kinyarwanda, or Arabic. I'm talking about universal ways we meaningfully connect with other people. In a time where media and politics and thought leaders are skeptical and pessimistic about our society, I can only think of the wise words of James Baldwin. Quote, "I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter." End of quote. Here are my favorite universal concepts to practice to build connections. I look to my mother tongue, Kinyarwanda, to title these universal concepts. 1. Dakuban, I see you. Acknowledgement we say in many countries surrounding Rwanda. This is a simple act of acknowledging someone's presence whenever entering a room. By doing so, you recognize that other person's presence, and believe me, it is simple, but it goes a long ways. Specifically when the person is not the center of attention. 2. Murakoze chane, you have done well. Always being grateful for someone's service, generosity, and most when the person's service is taken for granted. I have seen myself going around at the end of a large community gathering and thanking the music band for their religious act, thanking the staff for their world-class hospitality, or simply thanking someone for an enriching conversation. Being grateful for someone else's contribution to your well-being in general is paramount. 3. Gusik, smile. This human facial reflex is the most elegant, hopeful, inspiring, and contagious emotional attire one should always wear. This is the most humanizing act you can use anywhere you go. If you smile at life, life would smile back at you. This is one of my favorite daily philosophy and practice. 4. Ubun. I am because you are. This is a philosophy is dear to the Bantu people in sub-equatorial Africa. It is the belief that you feel the pain, the joy, the shame, the pride that your fellow neighbor feels. Therefore, your human experience is intertwined. To be compassionate to each other in our society is a must. Otherwise, we risk to become desensitized. I quote, "I am a man. I hold that nothing human is alien to me." End of quote. Terence Affer. 6. Urijitangaz. You are amazing. Complimenting someone whenever they do something praiseworthy. The validation of someone's accomplishment or attitude goes long ways. On the surface, it might seem like it was done painlessly, but this is the tip of the iceberg of the continued effort culminating to this glorious moment. 7. Ikaziwachu Murisang. Welcome home, feel at home. Hospitality without borders is important because we can get caught in our comfort bubbles, forgetting people stuck on the outside. Always be on the lookout of your diction, your body language, whenever welcoming someone. My mom once told me that you have to be the best host possible so that when leaving, your guest says, "I'm looking forward to coming back to your home." Now switch the word home to conversation or friends. You create a feeling people want to experience again. And finally, 8, Urukund, love. People must learn to hate, and if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love, for love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite, a quote by the late Nelson Mandela. This is a firmly held belief that we are wired to love each other rather than fear each other. Do you hear the difference between universal and human languages and national dialects? Which is uniting and inclusive? Which divides and excludes? I want to take this opportunity to thank from the bottom of my heart all the people that make me feel safe, welcomed, and supported in my adopted home. First respondents, public servants, teachers, mentors, refugees, neighbors, international students, visitors, and beloved friends, also known as my chosen family. I leave you with this. Dr. Maya Angelou once said, "I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel." This is Alexandre Cusa.
Cusa is a community liaison for Folkways, which works to nurture culture creators. He's one of the writers of the Think Global, Act Local column published in Fargo Monthly magazine. Coming up on Main Street, NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports about the effect of global warming on wild rice. Sue Balcom of the Root Cellars Farm near Mandan joins Ashley Thornburg and me to talk about canning, and Ashley and I will share our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Kitson County, Minnesota Sheriff's Office has opened a 23-year-old cold case on a missing woman. 41-year-old Becky Jo Look disappeared from Halma in October of 1995. She wasn't reported missing until February of 1996 by family members who lived out of state. Look moved to the small northwestern community with her boyfriend in 1995 from New Mexico. Sheriff Steve Porter and Chief Deputy Matt Viggs say there was talk at the time of her disappearance that Look left on a bus to return to New Mexico, but that has never been verified. Porter says information gathered since the case reopened seems to focus the disappearance on Kitson County, and in a Facebook post, he hopes more people will come forward.
We got a phone call. We spoke to two people. They gave us an emotional statement on information on this case. We have work to do. We got stuff to follow up on, but I am convinced that there are more people that know something about Becky. We need to hear from you.
During the initial investigation in 1996, the property where Look lived was never searched. The sheriff says a search is planned on the land, which includes a large swamp. Attempts to locate the man Look lived with have been unsuccessful. It's believed he lives in Florida and may be homeless. The National Weather Service is advising we could see near critical fire weather conditions Saturday and Sunday. Highs on Friday through Sunday could reach 100 degrees or more in western North Dakota.
See, as you drive down the road, the vegetation continues to cure, especially with these hot and dry conditions and with what we're expecting for Saturday and Sunday, adding a little bit of wind to that equation, could have the potential for critical fire weather conditions on Saturday and Sunday.
National Weather Service forecaster Patrick Ide in Bismarck.
The best thing to do is to keep an eye on the North Dakota Fire Danger Map, and then have a knowledge of what burn bans are or are not in place that are oftentimes tied to that burn ban or any red flag warnings. Look at the North Dakota Department of Emergency Services website or contact local or county or tribal emergency management or law enforcement. They can certainly help you out there. So I think that's the best course of action. They would have the best information on any burn bans or restrictions are in place and what you can and cannot do.
And the haze you see in the sky overhead is smoke from the wildfires in western U.S. and Canada, and it will stick around for the next couple of days.
We've got a nice, sustained upper-level ridge out over the western part of North America, and that is maintaining the clockwise circulation around and pulling the smoke down across the western Dakotas.
National Weather Service meteorologist Janine Vining in Bismarck says the hazy smoke will remain over the state until a system comes through later this week.
So we might have a little bit of a pattern switch Sunday into Monday as we get a weak cold front moving through the area.
Vining says individuals who may have breathing problems may want to limit their time outside with current conditions. She says to keep windows closed and air conditioners going to keep smoke out of homes. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
It's almost time to set sail for an evening Missouri River cruise aboard the Lewis and Clark Riverboat with Plains Folk essayist Tom Easer. Tom will read and discuss his new book, Pacing Dakota. So join Prairie Public and Tom this Friday, August 10th at the Riverboat Landing off River Road near Keelboat Park in Bismarck. We'll sail from 8 to 9:30 p.m. There will be a cash bar on hand and gorgeous views. Tickets are $35, which you can reserve in advance at prairiepublic.org, or you can get them at the dock the night of the cruise. So we hope to see you Friday at 8 p.m. for an evening August cruise with Tom Easer. Proceeds benefit Prairie Public.
Thank you for listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Climate change is causing more rain, and more rain means more flooding. And that is bad news for one Great Lakes region crop, wild rice, and bad news for the people who depend on its harvest. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports.
Northern wild rice, real wild rice, grows naturally in rivers and lakes all over Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and into Canada. And harvesting it is a group activity, especially in Native communities.
This is a family homestead.
Yep. The Couture family is part of the Ojibwe tribe. They live on the Bad River near Lake Superior, and Chris Couture remembers when he was a kid, lots of people would come harvest near their house.
You know, back in the day, you come out here during ricing time, and everyone came here. Everyone brought their boats. I mean, every canoe was lined up a whole way.
But the climate is changing, and some people here say it seems to be hurting the wild rice plants.
That used to just be filled with rice, and now there's not rice there anymore.
Dylan Jennings works for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. He personally harvests wild rice every year.
But our elders always talk about how lush and how just pristine all the wild rice used to be in our area here, and how thick it was. But nowadays, where I'm coming from as a young person, over the last few years, we've seen major flooding in the area. We've seen other environmental things that have come into play.
Things like a longer growing season, as climate change causes average temperatures to rise. Ecologists warn that a longer growing season may sound like good news, but wild rice has adapted to a shorter growing season. Longer summers actually favor other plants and let them crowd out wild rice. And then there's the flooding. There are more frequent and severe rainstorms in the upper Midwest. Floodwater carries sediment and pollution into the rice beds. Preliminary studies suggest that the cumulative effects of climate change are leading to more bad years for local rice harvests. Dylan Jennings says that's particularly hard on Ojibwe people in the region.
Wild rice is always used in all of our ceremonies and all of our gatherings, and so, we're dependent upon that. It can be really tough.
As climate change continues, good growing areas for the wild rice plants will be farther north, but the people who rely on it won't be able to follow. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
That story originally aired earlier this week on Morning Edition. Coming up on Main Street, Sue Balcom talks about canning.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and in our Bismarck studio, Sue Balcom of Rootsellers Farm near Mandan.
Thanks so much for joining us today. You know, we have this joke in North Dakota that there are two seasons, winter and road construction. But you are a farmer, and you are actually here to tell us that not only is there more than two seasons, there's more than four. You have what you call the fifth season. What is that?
Well, first of all, it's a book. If you Google it, that's not what we're going to be talking about. That kind of has sort of like a fantastic apocalyptic sort of thing, which okay. While we're preparing for the apocalypse, we need the fifth season because that is the season of canning. A lot of people in North Dakota are like, well, you know, you can't eat local all year long because, you know, we can't grow things but only 3 months a year. But that's not true at all. We eat local all year round, and we do it because we can. And right now there are pickles and beets galore at your farmers markets. So we start out the year with some jams and jellies, and we also start pickling this time of year.
Well, what's your favorite kind of pickling?
Oh my gosh. When my grandmother was alive, we used to go down there for holidays, and she would give my husband and I a jar of her pickles, and we would eat the whole thing right there. Mm-hmm. After we had lunch, we would have that jar of pickles. She had a knack for making them, so they were like effervescent, and they kind of like bubbled in your mouth like fine champagne. So it has been my goal for years and years and years to try and figure out how she did that.
Well, I grew up with watermelon pickles. My mother would slice up the watermelon. We'd dutifully eat it and spit out the seeds and all that. But we were actually waiting for the pickles because she'd use the rind to make the pickles, and they were to die for.
Oh, my gosh. That's one of my best-selling things at Farmer's Market are watermelon pickles. But I actually use the red part and a little bit of the rind, and they are so amazing. Just, I don't know what it is about pickles, but when we can our, we don't water bath them because there are bacteria in the fermentation process, this lacto-fermentation process, which is today's fancy word for pickling. Mm. When we go down in the basement, and we can't sell these because people don't get this, but when the lids are bulging and you open them up and the bubbles start at the bottom and go up to the top and over the edge, we're like, go get the camera. We did it. We've got the effervescence that my grandmother had when she would pickle her pickles, her cucumbers. It was like, oh, just like they are so to die for.
Boy, that's the kind of thing that other people might say, oh, botulism.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned.
You do not need to be concerned. I've done a lot of research into lacto-fermentation because, you know, at first when people started fermenting things, I would look at them and I'm like, what are you talking about? You mean like sauerkraut and pickles? Because my family has been doing this for years and years and years. You cannot poison somebody with this process. If you open up a jar, you got to use a little common sense. If there's mold on there because there was some other kind of contamination, or if they are soft and mushy and just, you know, just use some common sense. But if you do the fermentation process right, you cannot get sick from it. It's actually really beneficial for you to eat those pickles, eat those watermelon pickles, and then drink that juice.
Can you ever run into, like, you know, sometimes if you make your own beer, you get explosions in the middle of the night? Can you get pickle explosion?
Well, I've never had a jar explode on me, but I have had the lids puff up so much that we've had to break the band to get them open.
Wow.
And then we know we have the best pickles ever.
Well, when you're making a dill pickle, do you use some garlic? Do you throw a pepper in there, onion? What do you do to add to the flavor?
Okay, so my grandmother's recipe is pretty simple. Garlic, pickling spice, pickling salt. You can throw a little onion in there if you like. Your cucumbers, and then a great big head of dill. She used to put dill, I think, on both the bottom and the top of that jar. But when I pickle watermelon, I have to put in a little green pepper, a little carrot, and a little piece of celery, and a hot pepper. Now, you can put a hot pepper into whatever you want, depending on your personal preference. But I just get such a kick out of these women that come up to my booth at the farmer's market, and they'll pick up a jar, and they'll tip it upside down, and they'll turn it around in their hands, and they're going, you could compete in the county fair with these. They're so beautiful. I'm like, yes, I did it. So that's part of this. This is all eating is visual as well as anything else, you know. And so I just love pickled watermelon. And those go good with dumplings, too. In case you were wondering, the Germans are so healthy because they ate pickles at almost every meal. And that counteracts any kind of bad thing that you eat, because pickles are so healthy for you.
Well, you can pickle or can other vegetables, too. I mean, tomatoes, corn,
beets.
Carrots, beets, yeah.
Totally beets, man. Everybody well, I shouldn't say that. Not everybody loves pickled beets, but that's also a really popular thing that people remember from their childhood. And you can make those spicy or not so spicy, and you can make them sweet or not so sweet. But I really like pickled beets, too. And that's another thing that people would put the beet juice over dumplings. Anything that has that lactobacteria in it, which I can't pronounce and I'm not even going to try, actually helps create a healthy gut bacteria. And so that's why fermenting has become very, very, very popular. And there's all kinds of little devices that you can buy to, you know, let the air escape or whatever. But, hey, my grandmother used to take a big crock, and they would actually put in either whole watermelons to pickle. You know, they grew those tiny little round watermelons. They would put the whole watermelon in, the salt and the water and the garlic and that. And then they would lay a plate on that and weight that down with the big old rock that they didn't need for a building or something on the farm.
Wow.
And that's how they did pickles, too, in the crock. And so I was trying to explain to some the other day that only a person who pickles knows what a half-pickled cucumber tastes like, because that is kind of like they're a little crispier, they're not quite as sour, and they're not quite as effervescent. But you ask any of those little old German ladies, and they will talk about sneaking into the room where the crocks were fermenting, and they were eating these half-pickled cucumbers. I was going to call it a pickle. It's not technically a pickle till it's done. So.
Well, pickling, canning, it's the fifth season, as Sue Balcom has described it. Sue is with Ritzeller's Farm near Mandan, and she joins us every week on Main Street. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
Thank you.
What's happening is next.
This week on Away with Words, another case of one word with two completely different meanings.
The first time his extremely polite southern grandmother said that his grandfather was still feeling pretty raunchy, I about fell out of my chair.
Ooh, that sounds exciting.
Join us.
Then we'll have a big get-together and really make the night hideous.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, when Marvin Gaye asked that question with such urgency, Ashley Thornburg and I go right to the calendar and decide, you know, what can we share with the listeners about what's going on for fun?
And whenever the answer can involve ice cream, well, I start there. The annual ice cream social this Sunday, the 12th in Bismarck at the former Governor's Mansion State Historic Site. There is going to be a whole host of free family-friendly entertainment, including games, refreshments, and tours of the historic site. Free food includes hot dogs and, of course, ice cream. It's an ice cream social. That's kind of a thing. And there is going to be a group of fiddlers here. Johnny and John Lardinois will be performing three separate times at 12:30, 1:45, and 3:30. Again, this is Sunday the 12th in Bismarck at the former Governor's Mansion State Historic Site. An ice cream social with lots of other family activities, including the Gateway to Science, providing lots of fun educational-based activities as well. And it's free.
Well, here's a way to get people to downtown Fargo. A brand new way that they're trying again, actually. Charism Over the Edge. It's Friday in Fargo at the Black Building. That's downtown right on Broadway. Charism, in partnership with Over the Edge USA, will be bringing back for the second year an unforgettable and unique fundraising event. Participants will have the opportunity to rappel 110 feet down the side of the Black Building. Throughout the day, there will be ground-level entertainment and tables available for people to come and watch, hang out, and cheer on the brave edgers, as they're being called. The funds raised from this event will go towards providing opportunities for at-risk children to access Charism's out-of-school educational programs. It starts at 9 in the morning on Friday, goes until 5 in the evening, and you'll see people you probably know rappelling 110 feet down the side of the Black Building right on Broadway. And it's free to watch.
All right, sewing machine phobia. I definitely have this. Saturday the 11th in Jamestown at a place called Still Sewing Strong. And if you're like me and you attempt very rarely to do the occasional straight stitching and then you see these knobs and you don't have any idea what to do with them and are totally convinced you're going to mess something up because you totally have, then this class is for you. Again, this is Saturday the 11th in Jamestown at Still Sewing Strong, and the class is from 9 to 10 a.m., and it's free.
Well, how about the doggy dip on Monday in Moorhead at the South Park Wading Pool? You can bring your dog out for lots of water fun and swimming. Proceeds benefit the Moorhead Dog Park. Dogs should have a collar, ID tags, be properly licensed, vaccinated, and in good health to swim. You know, you want your dog to survive the doggy dip. It runs from 3:30 in the afternoon until 7:30 in the evening. Again, that's Monday in Moorhead at the South Park Wading Pool. It costs $3.50 per dog.
The 33rd Annual Village Fair is this Sunday, August 12th, in Rugby at the Prairie Village Museum. And this is another family-friendly event with food and music and lots of activities. Gets going with a pancake breakfast, and then there are games, activities, costumed actors. You can check out classic cars, an art show, a choir, a church service. Lots of events going on in Rugby at the Prairie Village Museum. Again, for the 33rd Annual Village Fair this Sunday, the 12th. Hours are from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and tickets are anywhere from free to $8.
Well, here's a story we've had on Main Street several times, the New York Kammermusiker's Winds of Change concert tour. It's actually touring, and on Monday it'll be in Fargo at the First Presbyterian Church. The New York Kammermusiker, a small double-reed chamber music ensemble that performs classical music, is returning to the state to celebrate its 12th annual concert tour. The group will perform concerts on both sides of the Red River for this anniversary tour. The group was formed in 1969 by North Dakota native Ilona Peterson, and it's a nonprofit organization that seeks to reintroduce the instruments and the music of the Double Reed Band to modern audiences. The group prepares modern scores from long-neglected musical manuscripts they seek out in their travels in order to bring the music of the medieval bands to modern listeners. So take this in. It's It's a big sound, actually, when you look at those relatively small instruments. It's at 7 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church in Fargo. That's Monday. It costs nothing. It's free. And check your listings. The Kammermusiker group is moving across North Dakota as we speak. There are a couple more concerts after the one in Fargo on Monday.
They often play at the Chahinkapa Zoo in Wahpeton. I was fortunate enough to take in that concert a few years ago. The Pride events, there are several going on in Fargo this weekend, including Pride in the Park. That gets going from 11 to 4, and that is at Island Park. There's going to be a parade on Broadway, a church service on Sunday. So this is a weekend-long event, so I can't give you the dates and times of every single thing. So the best thing to do is to check out the website, fmpride.com, and see where all the different Pride festivities are happening throughout Fargo.
German Russians in World War I is the topic at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum on Sunday in Bismarck. McIntosh County's German Russians in World War I will be presented by Gordon Eisenminger at 2 p.m. at the North Dakota Heritage Center. Eisenminger, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of History at UND, will discuss the German-Russian population of McIntosh County, their experiences during and after World War I, and the presentation will include experiences of young men who served, as well as the espionage trial of John Wishick, known as the father of McIntosh County, among the German-Russians. His trial was the most sensational trial held in the early years of North Dakota statehood. It's 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon at the North Dakota Heritage Center, and enjoy it. It's free.
All right. My pick of the week. Many of you know Scott Prebis as the host of Prebis on Classics and Prebis on Jazz. He is very well versed in both of those styles of music and is a musician himself. So he's going to be performing a concert that's neither classical nor jazz, but we'll get to that. He is going to be playing anything from Jimmy Buffett to Peggy Lee to Sade. This is coming up Saturday, the 11th in Stanley at the Sybil Center for the Arts. Scott Prebis and friends, 7 o'clock, and it's free.
Well, my pick is what we're calling the Tom Cruise. You can join Prairie Public and Tom Ezern for an evening cruise. This would be Friday from 8 to 9:30 on the Lewis and Clark Riverboat in Bismarck, and a reading from Tom's new book, which we've talked about here on Main Street, Pacing Dakota. There will also be a dessert reception, a cash bar. It will cost $35 per person, and you can get your tickets online at prairiepublic.org, or you can get them at the dock. Again, it's Friday, August 10th from 8 to 9:30 on the Lewis and Clark Riverboat on the Great Missouri River. And that's what's happening.
Considered asking the vice president to pay for my taxi. I thought it might be inappropriate. So I made up an excuse to avoid having lunch with the vice president of the United States to talk about saving the planet.
Join us next time for stories about trains, planes, and taxis. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
It was an incredible honor in 2014 to be at the White House to be awarded the National Humanities Medal. And I felt that the inscription, which meant so much to me, that the medal was for thoughtfully delving into the mysteries of human existence. To me, this showed that in the years in which On Being has been in the world and growing up on public radio, our culture has also come to a place where we're ready to develop a vocabulary of the mysteries of human existence. I think that we understand together a bit better than we did even 10 years ago. That these questions of what it means to be human and who we will be to each other are also going to underpin the flourishing of all of our other disciplines. How we create neighborhoods, how we create policies, how we build schools and prisons and hospitals, and how we are as parents and neighbors and citizens. I'm Krista Tippett. I hope you'll join me for On Being, Sunday nights at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 9th. The Missouri River has a plentitude of fish. Modern-day anglers seek to catch wily walleyes, ravenous northern pike, big catfish, and even paddlefish. Rough fish also abound, including bufflefish, goldeye, and bullheads. In former days, Native Americans harvested fish from the mighty Missouri. Some tribes depended heavily upon fish for food, while others did not. One of the tribes, the Hidatsa, used fish traps, drags, or fish hooks. On this date in 1908, the Bismarck Tribune published an article about Hidatsa fish traps, written by Ernst Reinhold Steinbruch. He had been invited to the Fort Berthold Reservation to examine a Hidatsa fish trap in a Missouri River side channel. His guide was Edward Goodbird. Fishermen built the trap using sticks from diamond willow trees, each stick being about 8 feet long and 1.5 inches thick. They placed the tall sticks in the shape of a circle near the riverbank. Between these willow poles, they fastened a kind of webbing made of smaller and thinner willow sticks closely tied together so that the river water could pass freely through while entrapping fish. At the lower end of the trap was a gate about 3 feet wide, which served as the entrance for the fish. Fishermen closed the gate when the fish trap had been filled with sufficient fish. The Hidatsa wanted catfish, so the bait consisted of putrid carcasses of dead animals. Fishermen tied the bones to one of the willow poles to keep the rotten meat from drifting outside the trap. The Hidatsa knew that the stronger the odor of the bait, the more attractive it was to the fish. Two men typically watched the trap overnight, silently using signals so as not to scare away the wary catfish. When enough fish filled the trap, the fishermen carried them onto the riverbank for cleaning. The men were very careful to avoid catfish stings, so they would keep very quiet in all their movements and not even whisper, for at the slightest noise, the catfish could stretch their sharp, pointy fins and cut the fishermen's skin. The Hidatsa ate fish on the day they were caught. They preferred catfish boiled rapidly, but oftentimes broiled smaller ones on a stick. These fish trap enclosures allowed the Hidatsa to supplement their typical diet of corn, beans, squash, big game, and bison meat in times long past. Today's Dakota Date Book was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Chicago had one of the most violent weekends in several years.
There are too many guns on the street, too many people with criminal records, and there is a shortage of values about what is right, what is wrong.
Now, some people in the city are battling the perception that it is the country's murder capital. We're going to examine how the city got that reputation on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Friday on Main Street, Jack Russell Weinstein talks about the Concordia Language Village German immersion camp near Bemidji. The camp's name, Waldsee, has a Holocaust connection, and they're trying to determine what to do about that. News Director Dave Thompson will join us on Friday with a discussion of the week's big stories, and Matt Olean always reviews a new film on Friday. Tomorrow it will be Eighth Grade. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.